Coaches, athletes, weekend warriors. Have you thought about recovery or regeneration? Today we oftentimes think in training about the stimulus we put on our body and the workload that we do to fatigue us daily. But we don't give enough to the recovery component. Simply Faster has numerous options to enhance your recovery in between the sessions of work that you put your body through daily. They have Theraguns, Normatic regeneration kits, and they're all cost-effective options. My athletes at my high school often use the Theragun in between intervals, race days, and training sessions. In the world we live in, it's hard to guarantee that we're going to get a doctor's visit. Simply Faster provides you the option where you don't have to be behind a paywall to get the care that you need with the equipment that they provide. So get yourself the regeneration and recovery that you need and level up. Simply Faster. Check it out. Welcome everyone to the Companions of the Compendium podcast. Today I have Olympian, world champ, nine-time collegiate All-American, TCU grad, Ronnie Baker. Super excited to have him on. And full disclosure to the audience, this is my first athlete who I've had on that isn't retired, that is in the mix, in the heat of the thing, having one of his greatest seasons he's ever had, making the Olympic team. Ronnie, we are so excited to have you here. How you doing?
I'm doing well, man. It's been a productive day for me. Nice Monday. And I'm doing pretty good, man. I'm doing pretty good. I'm excited to talk and just kind of relax and get some things out there. Yeah. So I'm excited.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. Yeah. It's one of those things where, like, you know, you reach out to people and you're a fan and it's weird. It's like you have friends and you're also fans of them at the same time. And you build these relationships with people digitally. And it's so cool to kind of like be face to face for the first time. And obviously we've communicated electronically and, you know, I'm a freaking big supporter of you. And, you know, and it's so funny to have that and be a friend and a fan at the same time. So it's pretty freaking awesome. So getting into it. You know, I've seen some interesting things, some of your experiences you had as a youth athlete. For those people out there that don't know a little bit about your background before you blew up to become one of the biggest track and field sprinters of all time, tell us a little bit about how you got into sports, who helped you along the way, and mentors and people that you look up to now.
Man, so getting into sports, you know, track and field was not my first love. I'll tell you that for sure. I was a basketball player. So I played a lot of like YMCA, you know, advanced league boys and girls club coming up when I was really young. I was actually running a little cross country, in Alaska. So I was doing that, but I wasn't super into the cross country thing. I was more into the basketball scene. And so, I really just did that. I did cross country. I did basketball. When I got to middle school, I moved from Alaska back to Louisville, where I was born actually. And Louisville, Kentucky is just basketball city. I mean,
right.
That's basketball town. So, you know, we played basketball. That's what I did. And I played basketball in middle school. I ran cross country in middle school as well. I did both. And then when I got to high school, I did the exact same thing, but I transferred. Instead of doing cross country, because you couldn't do cross country and basketball in high school at the same time. They happened during the same season. And so I just did track and field. And so I ran middle school track as well. But I got rid of the cross country after middle school and just went straight into track. And a lot of the people that really noticed me was when I got to high school, I went to the same high school my mom and dad went to, Ballard High School. They both graduated from there. And I went to a summer basketball camp because if you get to the summer basketball camp, you can kind of get in front of the coaches before, you know, tryouts and stuff. So they kind of, you're already on the radar. And they noticed that I was really fast. And so the coach at Ballard, was someone that I think taught me a lot. His name's Renner, Coach Renner. He was one time we were at conditioning or it was during the summer. He's like, he calls the track and field coach and he's like, hey, you need to come to the gym. And so the track and field coach comes to the gym. Renner has me do a full sprint down to the other side of the court and come back. And he's like, you need to talk to the track and field coach because he's like, you need to run track. And so Yeah, man. So that's how I got introduced to, you know, one, Coach Renner, who's a basketball coach, but then also Donald Goodwin, who is the coach at Ballard, the track and field coach. And those two guys have been super influential in my life. And yeah, man, they were the kind of the ones that said, hey, you're fast. And I always knew that, but I think that because even in elementary school, I was always the fastest kid. Like always, no one could beat me in anything. I was always the fastest kid. And then same in middle school. And then when I finally got to high school, I was so focused on playing basketball, but they were just like, you can play basketball, but you also like, you're going to be running too. Like to make sure you run. So yeah, that's kind of how I got, that's how I got into it, man. I was always running when I was younger and I just kept sticking with it and eventually got to the point where they were like, yeah, you need to do that. And on to college, I knew track and field was going to pay my bills as far as like getting me through college without having to pay anything, which is a blessing. Thank God.
Right.
And yeah, so that's the one I went with because I wasn't going to play D1 basketball. I was decent, but I wasn't like reverse dunking windmills, you know? Yeah. That was not me. So when you
got to college, I mean, what were your expectations? I mean, TCU is considered to be a sprint powerhouse. I mean, I think TCU has the highest number of people who've run under 10 seconds, whether they were doing it in college or post-collegiately. I mean, so that's like, I mean, that is the hotbed, the mecca, if you want to be a 100-meter sprinter. No disrespect to any other college program, but I mean, you know, it is what it is. So yeah. How did that feel coming into it? What was your attitude? Where were you at as you arrived at the mecca of 100 meter sprinting?
Man, let it be known that TCU has the most under 10 second sprinters of any collegiate program. I want everyone to know that because most people don't. It's true. And we held the record in the 4x1 for a very long time before Houston broke it, I believe in 2019, maybe? Mm-hmm. 2018, 2019. But yeah, man, one of the greatest like sprint programs in the history of college, right? And so honestly, for me, I didn't know about any of that really going into. I knew when I went on my visit that they did, that was a thing. That was like their claim to fame was they had a great sprint program. But for me, I didn't really think much of it. I was just kind of really understanding track at that point. But I knew that for me, work ethic is one of my core values. It is one of my core values. My core values are diligence and work ethic. No excuses. I hate excuses. I don't like people that make excuses. Usually if you're making an excuse, there's a way you can figure it out. You just are lazy and you just haven't done it yet. And so excuses, I can't take it. I can't deal with people that do that. So my core values are no excuses, being adaptive. My next core value is work ethic. My last core value is being humble. And so for me, I knew I was going to go into track and field. I was going to go into the collegiate program, one, with a blessing of being able to have a full ride scholarship, and I was going to work my butt off. Yeah. So it wasn't even a question for me whether I'd be successful. It was a matter of how much was I going to have to sacrifice? Like, how hard would it be? And that's what that was kind of the unknown, because I knew I was going to go in and give it my all. Like being at one of the, like you said, hotbeds of sprinting wasn't intimidating for me because I was like, I'm up for it. Like, I'm ready. I've gotten through so much in life that this is going to be a cakewalk for me. Now, was it a cakewalk? No, it took a lot of work.
Right.
But the thing is, my mindset, I was ready for the work. I was ready for the work. I was ready to put in the work. And that's what I did. That's why I'm here. That's why I'm here today, because I'm still putting in the work, and work ethic is one of my core values and it always will be. So for me, it wasn't intimidating. I was just like, it was cool. Cause now guess what? I had an opportunity to be a part of that history. Right. Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to join those guys. I had an opportunity to be in that discussion, and I am now. And so, yeah, it didn't bother me at all. I loved it. I loved the challenge.
So with Daryl, Daryl Anderson, your coach, what do you think separates him that allows so many people? Because I mean, let's be honest, not everybody is you. Not everybody has maybe those core values, and no disrespect to any of the other athletes. I know obviously they worked hard. They're very talented, all that kind of stuff. But each 100 meter elite sprinter like when you get to that low 10 seconds and then sub 10 seconds, everybody comes with a different puzzle. So how did Daryl, and what is about him that has allowed that program to be so successful and to bring so many people to those elite performances there at TCU?
That's a great question. I think he knows sprinting very, very well. His mind is it's unlike a lot of other coaches. And so I know that he knows what works. And it really is a matter of the people that have been able to work with him and work with him successfully. It's just really buying into the program. And so I think that he, for me personally, he knows my body. He knows me as a person. So outside of just like track and field and knowing what I can do, what I can accomplish, what's too much for me in practice, what's not too much for me in practice, like what specific workouts I specifically need to do. He's mastered that over the last 9 years that I've been with him. And so I think the one thing though, is he knows that, but it also requires buy-in from the athlete. If you're not bought in completely, and that's with anything, man. If you're not bought in, if you are halfway in, halfway out, if you're 1 foot in, 1 foot out, you can't be great. And you might be able to get a little success here and there, but when you're trying to make it to the level where you're respected in that arena, where you walk into the room and you command that room, or you're at the top of your game, or whatever the case may be, winning medals, making teams, you got to buy in. And if you're not bought in and your belief is low in what you're doing, then it's going to be very hard for you to run to that kind of level or perform at that kind of level or, you know, reach the top. So I think that's the biggest difference, you know, just being able to work with Daryl, him knowing me personally, outside of track and field, but just knowing my body, knowing when I come to practice and I'm upset about something that doesn't even have to do with track and field. And then me just buying into the program. He's very, very smart in what needs to be changed, what needs to be fixed. And the great thing about me is that I'm a very fast learner. You know, we could be talking about one thing in practice and he'll be like, hey, we need to correct this. And I can immediately correct it. And I think that's what is, that's what's helped me project to that next level. So he always tells me that I make his job really easy because he's like, I'm just out here. I'm just watching you, man. He's like, you need me out to be over here, but he's just like, you know, he gets out there and it's everything that we've done is so automated, that, you know, I travel, I don't have him when I travel a lot of the times, unless it's major championships, because I'm able to adapt and do things on my own, and I can send him a video. He can correct something and I can immediately fix it. And so, I think that's just one of the things that I think that every program's different and every coach is different for everybody. But I think that because the way he's had so much success is because he really knows what works. He knows what works when it comes to sprinting, and he has that base down. And he drills that into everyone he works with. And I think that's what separates him. He sticks to his guns. He's not afraid to adapt, but he knows what works. So that's I think that's one of the biggest reasons that I've had so much success. And he's had so much success with everyone that he's coached.
Yeah. I mean, 9 years is, you know, and first of all, and just track and field in general is quite a long time to be at an elite level, you know, so that's a real thing. And then the other thing is, I mean, you look at like how many elite athletes do we know stay with the same coach for that long period of time? I always feel like the vultures are constantly circling. If there's one bad race, if there's one bad block start, you know, everybody's sister, aunt, uncle's cousin, you know, whoever's got advice, they've got, you know, it's like when you have your first, Ronnie, when you eventually have your first kid, people are, if you, I don't know if you do have a kid yet or not, but you know, okay. So, but when you do, you're going to get a ton of advice about like, oh, well, you know, this is what you should do for this. This is what, you know, and it's unsolicited advice. So there's all that kind of stuff that happens with having children and having an athletic career, you know, that people are wildly interested in, you know, and it's funny how those things parallel. But what do you think you guys have been able to do that has allowed that to happen? You talk about he's so knowledgeable about what needs to happen. So talk to us a little bit about how that trust was built on these needs. What are things that you guys are getting done that makes this relationship work so well?
Here's what I know is that that relationship was built out of pure submission by me. And what I mean is, whenever you have someone that is coaching you or is a mentor of you, right? I think mentorship gets thrown around so much, and there's differences between mentors and coaches. And here's what I'll say: it was complete submission by me. That's how that relationship was built. Because as a person who, if you're coming into a coach and you want them to make you better, you have to understand, there has to be trust built there, and you have to understand that they know more than you. And if you think that you know more than them, now you're the coach. So go coach yourself, right? Go do it yourself if you know more than I do, right? So I think it was me completely, like I said, it's completely buying in, and it comes down to that submission, because there's a hierarchy of how these things work. And so, you know, it required me to submit my pride, my ego, just what I thought was best, right? Because what I think is best probably isn't the best. This guy's been coaching for over 30 years. So who knows more, right? Who's seen more? Who's coached more? Who's seen more different styles of sprinting? And so it comes down to that. And I think that that's one thing that a lot of athletes don't have. They don't do. They want to do their own thing. They think, oh, I should be doing more wickets, or I should be doing more sprint work, or I need to be doing more long intervals, or I need to be doing more block starts. And if you're in it, if you're in the circle of the training, you don't know what you need, because the coach is there to help you do what you do best. That's why I love programs that are already built. There's already systems in place, because as an athlete, guess what I want to focus on? I want to focus on winning. That's it. I don't want to focus on the right foot of the block and the, I don't want to think about that. I want my coach to think about that. My coach is there to watch me do that. He's there to see what's wrong. We're there to correct it in the practice, do it enough times where it's muscle memory. And now when I go out to the track, I don't have to think about it. I've done it a million times because my coach saw it beforehand and he said, hey, you need to fix this. So that's the job of the coach, is to be able, and he's done that over the years. He said, hey, this is what we're going to work on. We need to fix your second step and make it quicker, because when you come off the block, you're not covering as much ground. He's like, hey, you're not covering as much ground as I think you need to. So what we need to do to get you back in the race is we need to speed up your second step. So like, it's stuff like that that I never could have possibly thought of on my own, but it came down to me being submissive and not saying, okay, I need to get my first step longer, instead of just saying, okay, this is what we're going to do, this is what we're working on, and just submit to that. And understand that, you know, that person has your best interest in heart. They do. They should. And yeah, that's what it came down to. I think that's how the trust is built, because once I showed that I trusted him, he could trust me to do the work. And also he could trust me to just be submissive in that area and say, yeah, I'm willing to do that. And that's how that trust is built. And then from there, you know, you just have conversations about other stuff, about life, because you've built that trust in the area of running. And so I think that is key. The key is to, if you're going to go to a new program, whatever it is, be submissive in that area. So
it's so hard to do, though. You know, you talk about, I mean, and as 100 meter sprinters, I imagine that most of the people who are at your level, when they hear submissive or submit to the coach, they're like, I'm not going to submit to anyone ever. Like, that goes against everything, that every fiber of my being.
Yeah.
But I think that's, you know, and in that case, then yeah, that might make them great, but that also probably makes them pretty difficult to coach. And they're probably not going to have a long-term relationship with the coach. It'll be many coaches for a period time, whether it's a world championship cycle or Olympic cycle or things like that. But I always, the line I like to use, Ronnie, is surrender your talent to me. Surrender it. Be willing to surrender it to me. And then the other thing that's really interesting, you talk about, you said, I don't want to have to think about all these different things. I want to be worried about winning and going out there and working hard and being adapted to what my coach tells me and not have any excuses, just get it done. And what's really powerful about that, and I think it's interesting for the audience to hear, is that people don't realize how many energy leaks come from little things emotionally that build up. And so if you're constantly having to do the job of the coach, then you're not able to fully do the job of the athlete, right? Yeah. And so one of the coaches I really like out there, Stu McMillan, he and I had a conversation. And one of the things that Stu talked about is like, you know, the athlete feels what the athlete feels. You can't feel what they feel, but they can't see what you see. You know, recorded, they can't see what you see because where they're going and their coach's eye is going to be at a different spot than, you know, a coach who's been around for a really long time. And it's like, man, if you waste all this time and energy on all that stuff, it's like, then you can't perform and you've got paralysis by analysis. And that's really challenging, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's really interesting to hear this because, you know, obviously again, like people hear surrender or to submit and they're like, oh man, I've been told never to do that. You know, but the reality is for that strong relationship. And that's kind of the truth about, I mean, I think we know that friendships, romantic partners, family, like there are things that you have to surrender for the relationship to continue, for that bond to be strong. Like if a friend says, hey man, I need, you know, you to come over and help me move, you know, because I helped you put in a lamp. Well, then you got to surrender that. You got it. That's a contract. I have to follow through. I have to do my job to keep this friendship, this partnership going.
Yeah, I think that, I think for me, it's easy. It's the word submit. It's not scary for me, especially as being a Christian. That's something that you do. You make sure that you're in alignment with, for me, it's alignment with Jesus Christ, because Jesus is in alignment with his Heavenly Father. I'm in alignment with Jesus Christ. My wife's in alignment with me, and it's a hierarchy of how that works, right? You know, the kids submit to the wife, the wife submits to the husband submits to Jesus. Jesus is submitting to God, and that's how it works. That's how it works in my eyes. So when it comes down to, you know, specific things like a coach, yeah, that would be someone that God's placed in my life as a figure to help me get to where I need to be. So yeah, of course, submit's not a hard word for me.
So when we talk about training and he gets this training and all this kind of stuff, what are some of the key things that you need to have in your program that are really important? And then we can dive into the details, if you don't mind, a little bit about like, what does a week look like in the middle of like the Diamond League season, you know, and then we can kind of talk about some of the things you like, some of the things you don't like to do and the reasons for it.
Yeah. So, some things for me, I guess, specifically, I would say because of my injury history, I think we've been kind of, we've been a little bit reserved on some of the training. So a lot of my sprint work is, I mean, it's fast, but it's very moderated. If we run something stupid, it's like, why do we need to do five of those? You know, it's like, there's no reason. So, I think for me, you know, obviously in the fall, the base and doing a lot of the interval stuff and the longer stuff is absolutely necessary. I think that's absolutely necessary for anyone. You know, I don't know if there's really anything like super specific for Ronnie Baker. I think that I am a very general, like, I think everyone does base work. Everyone does sprint work. Everyone does, you know, sometimes most people do sled work or hills or whatever. Like, there's not any like cool, special secret thing that I'm doing. I'm just working hard. I'm just working harder than the average person, I think. And so, I don't think there's anything super special. But you know, as far as like what a typical week looks like, especially in spring season, like during the Diamond League, you know, traveling a lot, it's a lot lighter. A lot of sprint work. Usually we're just doing sprints. If we throw in something like longer interval, whatever, it's usually like some 200s, which are not hard at that point in the season. They're just to get heart rate up kind of thing. It's a lot of sprinting, 30s and 60s block starts, sometimes going 30, 60, 80, you know, a lot of just sprint work. I mean, that's pretty much it. Throw some 150s in there, maybe some 120s in there, any variation of sprints you can possibly think of, probably doing it. So not a lot of longer stuff in the spring. So yeah, I mean, it's not go to practice and die in springtime. It is more reserved, working on form, working on position, working on rhythm, working on running fast, but not running until you're completely exhausted. So that's more of my spring, like in season stuff. But yeah, that's kind of typically how it works. And I, like I said, there's not really anything specific for me. I don't think that I personally need or do. Yeah, some of the stuff I don't like, man, anything involving 300s, I don't like. anything involving 500s, I don't like. They're not fun. You know, the days I know that I have to go to the order that I'm going to be at practice, and you know, some of the last efforts and stuff I'm going to run are like 400s. I'm not excited about those days. Mm-hmm. But I still run fast times when I do them. And I know I need them. I think if you talk about, okay, what do I need? I need the longer stuff, even though I don't want to do it. Like,
so, you know, so saying that, like you're talking about base work, you're talking about the longer intervals, and I think most track and field sprinters would agree with you. They're probably not big fans of 300s to 500s and anything in between. But where does that tend to show up for you in your season? Do you still have that carried over into the spring and the summer occasionally as a reset? How does that look?
You know what? I think that's something that we had discussion about, and for a little while we do, like, I think there's one or two times where we carry that over. But it doesn't, for me, it, this season anyway, it didn't carry over a lot. And that, I think that was just because of the injuries that I've had. I was injured in 2016, 17, and 2016, 2017, and 2019. And so it got to the point where we need to change some things. And so I think mm-hmm. that there was a point where we're like, hey, we can't do too much, because that's resulted in me getting hurt multiple times. And mm-hmm. so I think we pulled back a little bit on that, and I had the best season of my entire career, and I also stayed healthy, which is great. So there's a formula. I think it's different for everybody. You know, some people need more of that stuff, some people need less of that stuff. And it just depends on who you are. But yeah, so I think a little bit of that will carry over next year. I think I'll be taking some of those threes and taking some of those longer intervals into the spring. It won't be crazy, because I don't think changing my program completely is the key or the answer. But yeah, I think it'll carry over a little bit. I think for sure it will.
So when you said that you changed some things, are you talking about less of those reps, less of those workouts that seem to not be there as often? Or,
well, yeah, I think in the spring, like dialing back on that. Got it. And that's just specific for every person. You might need mm-hmm. more, you might need less. I think in our case, we realize, hey, we don't need as much. I'm very talented, and I've been able to run really fast with doing a little bit less. And
yeah,
if that'll keep you healthy, then you can't run if you're not healthy. And right. If doing too much is going to result in you getting hurt, then you're going to be sitting at home anyway. So you might as well fix the program or fix what you're doing so that you can actually run and compete.
Totally. So with that, speaking of, so then what would a traditional like week, like Monday's this, Tuesday's this, Wednesday's this, if you had a competition on Saturday, how does that lay out for you in terms of rhythm traditionally on the average, like for a week, like this day I'm doing this, that day I'm doing that?
Yeah. So that really depends, because the schedule's always different depending on if I'm coming off a plane, if I'm doing, you know, if I've just traveled back from Europe 8 hours or 12 hours or 16 hours. But typical week, sprinting on Monday for sure, you know, especially if I had a weekend, like a long weekend off or a weekend off, mm-hmm. I'm going to sprint. So that could look like some probably block starts for sure, especially in the spring. Probably some 30s and 60s through beams. So yeah, that's what Monday looks like. Tuesday's usually like an easy day. We're doing like 10 100s, 50 for the 50 meter walk back. Wednesday, you're going to be sprinting again. I don't know the variation. Could be 150s, could be 120s, could be 80s, but it's sprinting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thursday, another easy day, light day. Could be just a shakeout. Could be some 200s. Could be anything. It could be just a weight day. Could be, I don't know. And then Friday, you sprint again. It's really just up every other day or, you know, depending on how the body feels. If my body doesn't feel good on Thursday, guess what? Friday, I'm not going to be going all out sprinting. I'm going to be doing something light. I'm going to be doing something easier. So it really just depends on how my body feels. But usually every other day is some kind of sprint variation or sprint day. And then if we need to go on the weekends, like a Saturday or a Sunday, which we usually do in the spring,
right.
Just because we have less days that we're actually like training hard, right. we'll do another variation of one of those workouts. But yeah, that's what kind of this typical spring looks like. And that's just because I think that's different for everybody. Like if you're coaching like high school or college, it's going to look different, you know, as a professional, we do a lot. I mean, my base works forever. So right. Like that, a lot of that, like you talk about carrying that over. I don't think necessarily a lot of the workouts get carried over, but the strength that I built for those that many weeks. Yeah, it gets carried over. It's really kind of, my coach says it's an insurance policy. You know, if you do get hurt and you have to take 2 weeks off, well, shoot, if you had a great, great fall training, you've had all this base work, you can almost get away with it, you know, being out for 2 weeks if the case, or if you need to do that. And it's going to suck coming back after the 2 weeks. You're going to suck wind for a while, but you'll get back into shape really quick.
And it raises kind of like your floor, right? It's kind of like, so at the, your floor is much, much higher. So even with an injury, it's like, we're not dropping all the way back down. We're not losing everything. You've kind of, I always look at like that type of training, a base of, first of all, it's like a base of what? Well, a base of speed, a base of performance specific to a 100 meter dash sprinter. You know, I'm sure you're not going to go out there and run 10 times, you know, 500 for a Monday workout or do anything like that, you know? And so it's one of these things where it's like, I don't think people understand the importance of developing that connective tissue over time, right? To strengthen those things up, to be able to move correctly at different speeds, you know, and to crescendo that it increased intensity and tempo. And I always look at it kind of like, you know, if I knew, I mean, I haven't had a chance to talk to Daryl, but it sounds like, hey, we've got this block that we're setting up so that whatever chaos happens in the spring, we're never going to fall too far away. We've got all this, like you said, insurance. I like to talk about being inoculated versus injuries and kind of having this resistance to stuff that happens so that if something bad would happen, you know, you can rely on the fact that you're not going to be super unfit, super unprepared, because some of those adaptations hang around a little bit longer, right? Then you have that in your back pocket. So if something like that would come up, you're prepared.
Yeah, absolutely. That kind of, I guess, pinpoints it. Yeah, just having that base and doing enough and doing, stringing enough good quality workouts together to where you have that, like you said, insurance policy. So where if things happen, kind of covered there.
That's awesome.
That's how I was able to, in 2019, go from not running a single race and get to the, you know, world championship trials in Iowa and get fifth place. How the heck do you do that? Right. It's because we had a strong base. We had a good fall. And even though I took almost 5 to 6 weeks off where I was like maybe doing two workouts a week and jumping on what are the treadmills?
The ones that you can run on, whether they're the ones that are you propel them. Right. Is that what you're asking about?
It's actually not that. It's the one where it's weightless. I can't think of the name of it.
Oh, zero G treadmills.
Yeah. The gravity, whatever. I can't think of the name.
Yeah.
If I was on it, that must be a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, just getting on that, you know, a couple of days a week and still being able to run what I did and place fifth I mean, two spots out of qualifying for the Worlds and only having run one track meet. So,
right.
I mean, it's, yeah, exactly.
It's crazy. So, you know, when people see you perform and they see you compete, I mean, it is one of the most, how can I say this? Obvious things about you is you're a very physically put together person. You look like more than most of the guys you compete against, like an NFL athlete. So weight room, I feel like, would be important. How do you handle this with the body that you bring to the line, which is different than some of these guys who look like whippets, you know, in a dog race, or these long folks? And I know you're not short by any means as a professional sprinter either. You're a fairly large person. And one of those things I would say too, one of the bigger guys in indoor track to ever win a world championship in the 60 as well. So I'm giving you a whole lot of braggadocio here, but how have you been able to develop that power, build that power? What does the weight room look like for you? Is there plyometrics that are a major component as well? How do you keep that body at that size and at that strength ready and primed to move really, really fast?
Well, I'll tell you this. I lost a lot of weight from 2019 to 2020 and 2021. I was running at like 187 back in 2018. And I was pretty heavy. I mean, I was a lot heavier than most people, especially for, you know, my height, 5'10". I was 187 pounds. And I was racing at that. And I ran 987 that year. Which was awesome. But I think that my coach, obviously he wanted me smaller. And so after that 2019 season, I really just stopped. I stopped eating as much and lifting as heavy. And I lost a good chunk of that weight. I lost about 10 pounds. And so I raced this year at around 175, which is a lot lighter. And, the weight room looks a little different. I had a different coach in 2018, like as far as my weight program was concerned. So I have a different coaching as far as like weights and track. So that just looked a little different. Honestly, it was more tapered for me to just gain strength but maintain the weight. I think that I was lifting really heavy in 2018. I also was not doing a lot of That was a bug of mine.
No, it's all good. I know for the audience, he's been slapping bugs for like the last 20 minutes. I've just been watching. It's hilarious on film. He's freaking swatting. Anyway, go ahead, man.
So that was a big thing. I was lifting a lot of weight. I was lifting a lot of weight in 2018. I got really big. And it was fine because I was moving well. I mean, I think if you're going to get that big, what you need to do is you need to maintain your flexibility in your joints, your knees, your ankles, hips, etc. If you can do that, great. You know, you can gain a couple pounds and you can still run fast. I did it. But I think that I needed to lose that weight in order to increase my ceiling or floor, whatever you want to call it, just my ability to be able to run faster. A lot of that was contingent on me, I think, losing a couple pounds. And I feel better. I feel like I can carry myself. I did feel this year a little bit like I had a little less power. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that actually translated into my race. Like, it felt like I didn't have the power, but I was I was really getting after it. So it was a hard adjustment. But the weight room for me, it's a lot lighter right now. Still in the fall, like, getting to those weights where I can increase my strength. So it is heavier in the fall just because you can't go that long without pushing your limits a little bit, right? You got to push your limits. Right. So you can, and it's not like I'm maxing out once a week or maxing out every day. It's just a matter of touching that weight and making your muscles and things aware that like, okay, this is a heavier day, or we're going to challenge ourselves a little bit, but it's not like I need to max out every week on bench press or max out on squat every week. It's just basically getting to the point where I'm not putting myself at risk to hurt myself, but also getting to the point where I can get stronger to build that base again for the spring when I'm starting to sprint and I have that insurance policy where I have that strength built up, but I'm not putting on a massive amount of weight. So yeah, do the typical stuff, like what every track athlete does, you know, snatches, cleans, squats, bench press, dumbbells, box jumps, plyometrics, Vertimax, you know, all that. It's nothing crazy out there. But yeah, just doing those things.
That's interesting. You know, David Oliver, before he retired and went into coaching, when he was with Brooks Johnson, you know, and obviously, again, a different coach, different type of personality and all this kind of stuff. But one of the things that really ended up working out pretty nicely for David was that he cut some weight, you know. And David, I mean, he looked crazy too. I mean, he was stacked, you know, but it was just like, it was a strange kind of stack to see somebody that cut, that big, with the muscle angles and everything that it was. But when he kind of backed off of the weights in terms of continuing to keep on that mass and everything, he had a resurgence and he ran really fast. And then obviously we talk about the 7 steps to the, you know, the first hurdle. And that was a big thing for him as well. And so that's really interesting. Last question on training here, and then we'll get into some stuff that, you know, the Olympic experience and the US trials this year and all this kind of stuff. Where, if you do have your plyometrics and you do have your weight training, where do you try to place that in your weekly program? Is it at the beginning? Is it at the end of a session? How does that work out for you?
You know, I don't actually design the programs myself. So
right.
That would be a question for the person that designs a program.
Right. Right.
But as far as like plyos, that's going to probably be at the end. I think if I were to be the person to plan it, I think I'd put it at the end of the workout. But yeah, I think that would be more of a question for that person, because it changes, and I just show up. Like I said, I'm not the one. I don't want to think about that. That's the beauty of my coaches, is that they're in the studies of, hey, this is the weights that we need to be doing. They're having conversations. All I have to do is show up and give my effort, give my talent and my ability, something that they don't have, right? We work together. They have the expertise in that area. I have the expertise in going hard. And so when I just show up, this is what we're doing. So for the people that are listening to this that want that information, I would be doing a disservice if I told you it was in the beginning or the end or the middle, because quite frankly, I'm not the one designing it. So I don't want to give you that information and then you try to apply it and then you say I'm a liar. So
hey man, we love honesty, you know. So yeah. That's good, man. I appreciate that without a doubt, because that, you know, when people are like, oh yeah, well, you know, they kind of do this, and then they're like, wait, what? You know, that doesn't sound like that jives or connects at all. So yeah,
I don't want to be that guy.
All good, man. I appreciate your very openness and willingness to discuss all this stuff anyway. But one of the things I found, you know, really interesting for you is that obviously because of some of the injuries and different things that you have battled and work your way through this year, getting through, making the Olympic team with the US trials, with a year and a half in front that had like coronavirus and all of the crazy things that have gone on. Talk to us about the Olympic trials and that experience and the mental angle of that and the mental game of that, all those things you were going through as you're going through the trials. Cause I know we were about to talk about it before we started recording, and I didn't want to lose the juice before we hit the record button. So give us a little breakdown on how that played out for you and that experience just in general.
Yeah, the Olympic trials was an experience. I think that I had been to the Olympic trials in 2016, but I was a college athlete. I was coming out of college, and that was the year that I was injured. I was dealing with injuries in my collegiate career. So, I mean, I never made a 100 meter NCAA final, not one year. And that was because the last 2 years, one, I false started in my regional year at Texas, and my junior year sucked, but it happens. Then, you know, just not being focused. And then my senior year, I was hurt. I was just dealing with injury. And so getting to this one and having the kind of having that pressure of like, hey, you're one of the guys that's supposed to be on this team. And just having that and knowing that I was in a position where I was healthy. I had a great season. I was running really well. I feel like there was more pressure on me because I was like, hey, like, you could really F this up. And also, this was my contract year too. So imagine, like, you haven't made an Olympic team. You haven't made an outdoor world team. It's your contract year for your company. They're like deciding that they're going to sign you again, basically this year. You're supposed to, everyone's talking about how you're supposed to be on this team. You're in contention to win the thing. Imagine all of that. And then, you know, this being the first time where I made and I was healthy and I was ready. And like, if I don't make the team now, it's like, do I ever make the team? Right. And so I think that there was a lot of immense pressure on me just from that standpoint, because I was like, man, I got to do this. Like, this is it. Like, there's no excuses now. Like, you're not hurt. You're not dealing with any injuries. Like, this is it. You got to do this. And so emotionally, it was taxing. It was so taxing. And I didn't really realize how taxing it would be, but just the amount of nerves that I had going into that final race was immense. And I didn't let anybody know that. I didn't tell my coach that. But, you know, you always have that when you're going into any race. I think at any big race that you have, you're going to have some nerves. I think that's with everything you do. I think that when you're nervous, though, it means you're ready. I always tell myself that. My uncle told me that a long time ago. He's like, man, whenever you're nervous, that means you're ready. And I don't know if he was BSing or if he or what, but like, I've always taken that with me. I've always been like, I'm nervous. That means I'm ready. I'm nervous. That means I'm ready. And it's just a mindset. It's a perspective. And so, yeah, that's why, that's how it was, man. And afterwards, I think I've been telling this to everyone. It's like when I finished and I crossed the line and I realized I made it, I was like, whew. Like, it was just more of a like relief more than like excitement. Cause I was like, oh, that's over. Thank you. Now I can get to the Olympics and compete at the Olympics. And so, yeah, man, I think that, I think it was more of a kind of a monkey off my back than it was like, yeah, I made the team, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just relief. And I didn't realize that I would have that much emotional energy spent in that one moment, but it was a lot. And I think that that plays a big role in making that team and being there. But once you have, I think it'll be easier next time. I think it'll be a lot easier to handle because I've already been there and I know what it's like. But the first time was definitely one for the books.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I had a young lady, her name's Emily Sisson. She was on the US team with you. She set the Olympic trials record in the 10K. And it's one of these things where when she was in college, I mean, I coached her in high school, by the way, I have nothing to do with her now at all. It's Ray Tracy. She's a super talent. And I just so happened to roll the genetic dice and have this kid at my high school. Right. And then her teammate was a stud too, who was, Diane Robinson, who was also an All-American. I mean, it was just an embarrassment of riches for a period of time there.
Yeah.
But it was so crazy because when she won her first national title, I remember her father saying, oh my God, the pressure is just so much because she was so far and away better than everybody else. And I'm like, what? It took me a while to process that because I'm like, but she's so far and away better than everybody else. What has she got to worry about? And it's like, because of that, the only direction that someone can go is not a positive one, right? Right. And so right. I'm sure that that's kind of what you were feeling like. Hey man, I'm kind of like me and, you know, Bermel are kind of the two big dudes here, you know, before Curly decided he wanted to step down and start running short sprints and blow everybody's mind, you know, but it was one of those things where it's like, you know, it's the expectation of you have to be the person, you know, and it's one of those things. It's like, well, maybe, but you know, also the United States team is, you know, the hardest team to make. You have to run a bunch of rounds. Everybody's at their peak or close to it when you're at that particular facility. Mm-hmm. You know, Eugene has all that history. And so I could imagine that the emotional load of that is immense, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think two things. I want to clear the air because a lot of people will be like, oh, maybe that's why he didn't do as well as the Olympics as we thought he would, because, oh, he had all that pressure on him. And I think that one thing I got rid of most of my social media. I had a lot of my media team posting stuff for me during that time. So I wasn't on it. I wasn't watching the media. So that was one good thing. But like, it's interesting because I felt that pressure while I was at the trials. But honestly, when I was at the Olympics, I didn't really feel any of that. I didn't feel any pressure, which is so weird because Olympics is obviously a way bigger stage. But yeah, I didn't have that same kind of like feeling of like that weight, you know, which was interesting. But yeah, I just wanted to clear the on that because there are a lot of people that be like, oh man, well, carried over. No, I actually didn't. I think the trials was just different. I think the trials is hard. Like, it's hard. There's like a lot of people there that are there to take the spot. And everyone is so sharp. Like you said, like everyone's in the best shape. They're in their best shape. You have to be at that meet. If you're not, like, you might as well just watch from the stands. So
yeah. And the people who aren't track heads don't understand either. Like, sometimes I know this is going to sound like blasphemous, but there are particular events in the USATF trials that might actually be harder than the world, that, well, the Olympic finals, and then in some situations maybe even the world finals, depending on, like, especially the women's 100 hurdles, right? Like, Americans are so dominant in that event, you know, on the female side, like, that event and oftentimes is the best at the USA trials, and the Olympics are kind of like a, well, you know, and obviously everybody's got to get there. They got to clear the barriers. You got to run through the rounds in the 100. You got to be clean in terms of your block starts. You can't have any twitches or any false starts. And oh my God, at the Olympic trials, all of those false starts and all of that stuff was driving me bonkers with those blocks. I mean, what the heck was going through people's minds with that?
It happens every year. I mean, even if you go back to like 2016, you watch the team trials, the same stuff happened. Multiple start. It was probably bad. It was probably worse this year, but it happened in 2016 too. It's crazy. But yeah, man. I mean, a lot of athletes will tell you that. They'll tell you that competing at the trials is way harder than at the Olympics. A lot of them will vouch for that. So it's not, I don't think it's crazy. I mean, I heard that before I was even on an Olympic team. I've heard other retired athletes or athletes that are still running on the back ends of their career say that multiple times. So,
well, yeah. And then being in the Olympic, like, that's the thing too. Like, you're an Olympian. They can never take that away from you. There's nothing that can be done where you're no longer that Olympian. No matter what the performance is, no matter what the outcome is, you're always an Olympian. And that carries with it an immense, powerful weight and accomplishment. And I know, again, with Emily, like, nobody cared that she had made a world championship team previously. I didn't get one phone call. You know, she makes the Olympics and all of a sudden people are congratulating me. I'm like, dude, I had nothing. This kid was a freak, you know, of nature stud. And I was just happy to coach her for the very teeny, teeny, tiny bit I got to coach her and did, you know, very little in the overall process of her career. So speaking of making the Olympic team, talk to me about like some of the things that were really surprising to you when you got to Japan and Tokyo. I know that like you guys had probably more restrictions than you normally would because of the coronavirus and the different politics of Japan with coming with the vaccine and everything. But were there things that did surprise you that you know, besides the weight not being there in terms of like the same kind of intensity, stress level or anything like that, that the trials had? What were some other things that surprised you about that experience or you found really interesting, really cool? And it doesn't have to even be track or field related at all.
Man, well, obviously there was no fans. So that was different. I mean, imagine being in such a beautiful, big stadium with just no one there to fill it. I mean, that was just, to be honest with you, it didn't affect me. I don't think it affected any of the athletes. There were so many bomb performances. Like, I don't think anybody even cared. Honestly, to me, it felt like there were people there. Like, I remember the final and I feel like there were thousands of people screaming still. It didn't even feel silent to me, which is weird. But maybe it was just in my head. But that was one thing. And then I kind of knew the situation. I'd been on a world university team before, and it's kind of the same thing. They build a village, there's athletes there.
So I knew the system with like the beds and stuff wasn't going to be great. Like I knew that was going to be, we're going to be on little twin beds and we're going to be sharing rooms with people. Like it wasn't surprising. Like, oh man, this is the Olympics. Like, you know, I knew how it was going to be. So that wasn't super surprising, but for people that think we get like these immaculate hotels with these, you know, room service and stuff, it's very opposite. It's the crazy thing is that people don't understand that track and field, like if you are a glamour person, it is not glamorous. I will tell you that, like traveling, getting on buses, trains, automobiles, like it's not, you're not flying charter like these NBA players. Like you're not pulling up to the airport and someone grabs your bags and, you know, it's you're on your own, man. You got to do all that stuff on your own. And then even at the Olympics where it's like the Super Bowl for us or the NBA championships or the, you know, the World Cup, you know, it's, we're dogging it out, you know, thugging it out, man. We're in twin beds and sharing rooms and, yeah, it's not glamorous, but I knew that was going to happen. Like I knew that was the case. I think it was just like, it was kind of a bummer that we didn't get to go outside of the village and see some of Japan. I was really looking forward to some of the sushi that I was going to get to eat. Because you know, you're right in the backyard. Like, you know, you're in America, you get the stuff from your local sushi restaurant. But when you actually have some real like Japanese cuisine,
right,
you'll never go back. You will never want to go back. There's a place in Fort Worth and it's like one of the best, it's the best sushi place in Fort Worth, hands down. It's super expensive. Everyone in there is Japanese, so that's how you know, like you go into somewhere if there's a bunch of black people making sushi, you ain't in the right place. You are not in the right place and you know it. You know you're not in the right place. So I mean, that's how you know. There's people that grew up in that, like eating that stuff. They're preparing it. It's all fresh. And I had that, man. And I promise you, I can't. Every time I go and try sushi somewhere else, I'm like, it's just not the same. And that was the one thing I was looking forward to. I was like, man, I can't wait to experience that. And obviously couldn't leave the village. So it was, that just didn't happen. So I'll have to go back and actually get in there, you know, and do it right. So that was really, man, out of anything, I just wanted to be able to see Japan and then just the stands being empty. But I think if you're a competitor, you don't even notice it. You're so zoned in on what you got to do that you don't even look at the crowd. So,
yeah. So how do you guys handle, you know, in terms of the behind the scenes stuff? Like if an athlete is really talented and they have a chance to be a pro, and obviously, like you said, things aren't glamorous, but if there were like three things that you could give a future pro, like these are things that are hacks that you do, life hacks or things to be aware of that is crucial to the success of a international track and field athlete that they didn't tell you when you finally got into the game outside of TCU in international track and field, what would those three things be?
Man, those three things are, so there is a, I'd say that there's a couple things you can do if you're able to spend some money. Very crucial. Any flight over 9 hours, fly first class if you can. If you can. Now that's not, personally, I have personally not been able to do that. But if you can, fly first class. They'll make your travel so much easier. Your legs will not be as bad. They'll still be bad, but right, they won't be as bad. Another thing, if you got a little extra cash, take someone that does your therapy, take them with you. If you're going over there for a long period of time, that's key. Most athletes don't have the ability to do that. And that's just one extra thing that you can do. And then obviously that costs a lot because you got to get a flight. You got to get, you know, it's expensive. It is an investment though, because you have to think about everything as an investment. It's an investment for you to get more out of your body so that you can get paid more, right? You can win. So those were two, and I'll just keep going. I'll get more than three. Those were two, just like if you have the money, do it. If you're not, I'd say get some Normatec boots, a little bit less on the spectrum. there is a routine that as soon as I get off the plane, I'm in my room. I'm in those. I'm hopping in. I'm in there for 30 minutes, feet up, blood flow, like constant. That's one thing. And doing that, I do that multiple times before I run. Like if there's a couple, like 2 or 3 days before I run, I'm in those things like clockwork. And that's just getting this blood cycling, getting the fresh blood flow in there in your legs. That's one thing. If you can find like a base camp over in Europe that you can stay at, that'd be two, especially if you're going to stay over there for a good while. If you're gonna do more than 3 races over there, you don't want to fly over there, fly home, fly back, fly home, fly. It's gonna take so much out of you. If you can find a nice place to stay and train over there, that'd be the best thing. And then last thing, pack light. That was my biggest mistake. So I'll tell you a story. My first time going overseas in 2017. I brought a big suitcase because I was going to be over there. I went over there for like 3 track meets. So I brought a big suitcase. I brought a small suitcase, a backpack, and I had my Normatec boots with me, and I was carrying them in a little case. So I had like 3 different things I was carrying. And this is my first
You were like moving in, man.
Basically, I was moving in. I was going to be over there for like 2 weeks. So I was like, man, I'm packing. I'm like, all right, I need this. Pack light, find somewhere to wash your clothes. That's going to be your best option. But yeah, so I had all that. And I remember we had to, like in Europe, the elevators are very small. And like we had to walk up 6 flights of stairs. It was very, I remember this day, I got a workout in before I even ran because I was sweating. Up those, I had a backpack on. I had two suitcases and another bag that I was carrying and lugging up these 6 flights of stairs. And I was like, I will never, ever pack heavy ever again.
Oh my gosh.
I will never do it. And then I remember, like, while I had that, you know, I ended up going to another meet because I ran fast and my agent was like, hey, you got invited to this meet. It was the indoor Birmingham meet. And they was like, oh, you got to go to that meet. I was like, cool. Money, whatever, I'll go. So I still had that. I ended up staying with a friend, a family friend of mine who actually was my roommate in college. His parents live in the UK. And I remember they dropped me off at the train station. And I remember with like 2 bags, I had to like carry the bags because you have to like get onto the other side of the train, like where the train comes. I had to carry that bag up like all these stairs, carry it all the way down. It's just a hassle when you have that much stuff and you're trying to get on a train or, you know, just get around in general. Oh my gosh, it is awful. So yeah, don't pack a lot of stuff. Take what you need and leave what you don't at home. Rewear stuff and find somewhere to wash your clothes. And I promise you, you will thank me for sure, especially when you get to the professional level. Because traveling with all that luggage is not fun.
So how do you handle when you get to the meet and you don't have, like, you know, a caravan of luggage on your shoulders and things like this? What have you ever had to deal with, like, certain wild personalities in like the call room and these guys still trying to do the crazy bravado stuff or any of this kind of getting in your personal space? Or do they kind of leave because you're so chill? Like, I don't know, like, if they get to try to, they would try to get something out of you or try to get you off your game. Cause you seem like such a nice guy. And not to say, full disclosure, not to say that 100 meter sprinters aren't nice guys, but I think about, like, you know, the nonsense that Mo Green used to do and all that kind of swag and everything else. So like, how do you guys handle that when you're traveling and you have to see these guys a couple times at these different European meets and stuff like that? Does it kind of get to be a rivalry? Or are you guys kind of like all kind of like buddies? How does that play out?
It's interesting. I think that it's not as like in your face stuff. Like, people are very to themselves most of the time. Pretty much all the, I haven't really had any wild stuff happen. You get the occasional scream or claps every once in a while, but yeah, it's not like in your face kind of like trash talk. I think that a lot of the guys in the circuit are very close. They're a lot of them are more buddies than they are rivals. I think that changes when everyone gets into the warm-up area and it gets serious. Then it's like, hey, we're not talking. And you might wave, you might say what's up, but it's not like a full-blown, like you guys aren't hashing it out unless you're teammates or something. But I think everyone just turns on their competitive nature when everyone knows, like, hey, we're here to compete. Like, we get it. Like, we had lunch together, we talked, we're friends, but we're here to compete. We're all here to win this race. And so, but I think for the most part, everyone's pretty chill. Everyone's pretty cordial. No one's doing any wild things. You do, like, again, you do get the occasional scream at the start line or the claps and stuff. And I don't know if it's to throw people off. Maybe it's just to hype themselves up. But I always like give them like, whoa, like, what was that, man? Like, what's going on? You know, for me, it sometimes catches me off guard. It's like, holy crap, this guy's pumped up. But you know, hey, it for me, it doesn't bother me. I just kind of laugh it off and just do what I got to do. So, yeah.
So you get to the Olympics, you get a chance to compete. You know, walking through those rounds and everything and doing the thing, not walking, but you understand what I'm saying, getting through the rounds and doing the stuff that you needed to do. Talk about that process. How did you handle the media? How did you handle the nights being in these weird rooms where you got a roommate and you're sitting on these cardboard beds and all that kind of stuff? How did that play out for you?
Man, so honestly, I didn't really have a lot of media interaction. I don't think anyone did. Because of all the COVID protocols, we didn't really have a lot of media interaction. I think the media was kind of actually, they were shut off from us. Like they were kind of like in their own space. So I don't think anyone really had any media until after they competed or they won a medal, then they got like media time. So yeah, that wasn't even really an issue. I mean, the thing that we had to do was we had to take a COVID test every morning. We had to spit into a tube. Like the first thing you wake up, you're spitting into a tube. To just, you know, make sure you don't have COVID. But as far as like, that was really the only protocol that wasn't really out of the ordinary. Just had to wear a mask everywhere. And, you know, it was a little like at the cafeteria and these like basically screen, like not plexiglass, but like, I guess like some kind of barrier there. So like, we can't, like, in order for me to talk to you, it'd be talking through like a glass, like a window basically. But nah, man, the media wasn't really like, they weren't there. Like they weren't really around. I think that after the race, after you finish each race, you have to go through the tunnel of media. But you know, for the most part, if you didn't win or you didn't perform well, or it depends on who wanted to talk to you. So yeah, it wasn't super hard to really deal with. Honestly, it was kind of a breeze. I think it was easier than I thought it was going to be. A lot easier.
So looking ahead and thinking about the future, because obviously you kind of let the cat out of the bag a little bit, but you're like, you know, next time, yeah, you know, it's, you know, maybe it'd be a little bit different. So obviously I assume the design is that, hey, we're going to Paris, and that's because we don't have as many years in between. So, you know, when we're looking at the plan and we're looking at this year and we're looking at Ronnie moving forward, what are some goals that you want to get done? Because first of all, man, you and I are going to have to grab a coffee or something after you're done competing, because I will be at the World Championships in Oregon. I'm coming. So we'll have to at least, you know, when you're done and you make the world champion, you know, you make that final, you get that world championship medals and all that kind of stuff, we'll have to celebrate with a coffee. But that's next year. So looking to next year and then beyond, what's the plan? What are your thoughts? What are you wanting to do? What are some things you want to dabble in or try? If there's anything new, what does that look like? What's the future for Ronnie?
That's a good question. I definitely am going to dabble in the 200. Not even dabble. Like, I'm going to run the 200.
Yes, that's what I want to hear, man. Not just run it, man. You're going to race that stinking thing, dude.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many. Yeah, you're going to get me on my. I'm sorry. I got to interrupt, but you're going to get me on my soapbox. There's so many dudes that are like indoor dudes in the 60, in the 100 meter dash. And I'm like, you got to run the freaking 200, because that stimulus that you get from that doesn't match up with like some other stuff that we could get done at practice. And it's like, so many people be like, oh man, well, you know, my back does this when I run the two. I'm like, get out of here. There's guys that run that stuff all the freaking time. All right, so I'm super excited. Okay, go on.
Yes, 200. Well, I'll definitely be running that. I don't know if I'm going to – I don't know right now if I'm going to try for the world team in the 200, but I will be running more – I will be running the 200 next year. I'll be running that. I'll be racing that, which is awesome. So going to be doing that. It's about time I get in doing more of those. Don't go look up my 200 PR. It's pretty sad. But I definitely will be lowering it this year.
Yeah. Yet. So, right. Yeah. Yet. You don't want to see it yet, but yeah.
Yet. So that's a goal. Obviously world championships. For me, I know for a fact that I can run. And I think everyone knows that I can run 6.3. I think the world knows that. So that's not a secret. I'll probably be running some indoor this year. And really I want to prove to myself that I can do that, because I think in 2018 I should have done that, but I just never got there. So I think 6.3 is a definite goal for me. Just putting myself in that category with, you know, Christian and Maurice. So yeah, go ahead and do that. So I'll be running some 60s, and then honestly just trying to get some medals, man. World champ, two world championships back to back. Obviously I'm going to be running through the Olympics in 2024. So, yeah, I think that because of the way that it's stacked up, I probably, if I don't compete, if I don't try for the 200 this year, it might be something I try. We might try to double the year after. That's talks. That's like potential right now. But yeah, I definitely want to get into more 200 so I can be in the 19 club and 9 second club. And who knows, may try to run 44. We don't know yet, but that might be something that I try to do. Cause I started in the 400 and I think that it might be kind of like a, let's run one, see where we're at. Let's maybe run one or two more and just try to like put one out there just to squeeze in maybe at 44.9. But
right.
I think it's a lot harder than I think it is. So yeah, there's talks that I might try to go ahead and get in that club. There's only a couple of people that have done that. I know Wade's done it. Curly's done it. Norman's done it. Tyson, maybe.
Tyson Gay. Yeah. Yeah.
Usain Bolt. Potentially, yeah, he's done it. Maybe.
I don't know if his 400 ever was that fast in international. I mean, as a youth, he was super fast, right? In comparison, but I don't know if he got to that time or not, you know, gotcha. Maybe a split, you know, but yeah, man, yeah. I think you're fully capable of that. And all these people that are like, you know, oh, all you need to do is run 10 meter flies and never do anything else. You know, so come on, man, you gotta race that longer stuff, man. I know it hurts a little bit, but it hurts good. Cause then you're going to get all the benefits of all that stuff that comes down the pipe. That'd be super cool, man.
It hurts so good, man. It hurts
yeah. So good. Well, hey, Ronnie, I appreciate you coming on with us and talking with us about all the different experiences you've had, some of your training, some of the talks about the emotional pressures and all the goals and the opportunities. And dude, I've always been a big Ronnie fan because of how you take care of yourself, how you carry yourself as an athlete. You are easy to root for, easy to be excited about. And if anybody's going to do the things that you just mentioned that you want to do, it's a person like you who puts all those things together with a good coach, with the right attitude, with the spiritual alignment, with his Holy Father. All of that stuff is freaking awesome, man. So I appreciate you coming on today and talking with us in the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate it. I love doing these podcasts where it's chill. We're kicking back. We're talking track. I love it. So thank you for having me on. I really do appreciate it.
Absolutely. And if anybody wants to follow you on social media, what's the best way for them to do so?
The best way would be on Instagram. I'm getting a lot more active on there. It's Ronnie, R-O-N-N-I-E underscore Baker 14. And then if you just search Ronnie Baker on Facebook, you should be able to find me there. Those are my two most prominent platforms at the moment. So yeah, and Instagram is going to be used more than Facebook. So that's where you'll find me.
Well, Ronnie, thanks a lot. And to the audience, make sure that you share this out. you know, don't let this information die on a vine. If you're a track nerd like me, a track head like this, we get rare opportunities to talk to someone who is at the level that Ronnie is at while he is doing it and being so open and willing to share all this information with the audience about his experiences and everything that he's been doing. It's a treat and a pleasure. So to the audience, remember, be smart, be safe, make good decisions. We love you. Peace out.